Good morning. We'll go ahead and start. John Parks is listed on there. I don't think he's arrived yet. So my name is Steve Mayfield. I'm one of the participants here in this panel discussion, or not panel discussion, but report on a field trip that was taken in May. If this session is the one on the deadly scroll, a forensic examination of a lead plate that was found a year ago at the state or the National Park Service in at Lee's Ferry by a member of the National Park Service. Let me introduce the person who will give you most of the forensic examination. This is George Throckmorton. George was, you were born and raised here, right? Born and raised in Salt Lake City. He has a bachelor's degree and a master's degree in criminology from Washington State. He has a distinguished career in forensics and law enforcement. He was a detective in the Ogden Police Department during the Hi-Fi killings, involved in that. But his claim to fame is forensic document examination. For those who have been on Mars or haven't been here for a while, George is one of the forensic document examiners that broke the Mark Hoffman case. And you can read about that, or his work in that matter, in the book Salamander. But he has also worked on a number of other items, including sports memorabilia. He's appeared on 60 Minutes discussing that. And last year was brought in by the National Park Service to look at this score, along with another forensic document examiner out of Phoenix named William Flynn. William Flynn also worked on the Hoffman documents. George has worked for the State Crime Lab, the Utah Attorney General's Office, and for the last 9 years he has been my boss at the Salt Lake City Police Crime Lab. And without further ado, let's turn it over to him because we need to get along. There's a lot of material we need to do with. So, George.
Thank you. Back row, can you hear me? Is this working?
Yeah.
Because I'm going to be standing over here, so I'm trying to adjust my voice so you can hear. Can you hear me now?
There's going to be a tape.
Yeah.
That'll be interesting to see how that's going to happen. This is normally how I talk. I don't know how that's going to
happen. He does that to me all the time, walks away from me.
I hope this, you really do want me to stand here, don't you?
Yeah, I do. Stand still for a few.
I'll stand here for a couple of minutes. It's kind of fun being here. This is the third time I've been here over the years. The previous two times we talked about Hoffman. Today we're going to be talking about Hoffman. They say there's one-hit wonders. Man, that's what I think I am sometime. But anyway, I'm going to talk about something today which I don't know how many of you are familiar with, and I hope it's going to be kind of interesting. It is to me because that's my profession, and has been for a long time. But it's how do you do a forensic examination, especially on this lead plate. Is there anybody here that does not know what I'm talking about when I say the lead plate? Okay. I mean, since that was the title of the program, I hope you understand that. Where's my talk? Thank you.
You're welcome.
I have to correct one thing that Steve Mayfield said, as long as he's known me. He's got his degree, too. I've got my degree, but it's not in criminology. It's in criminalistics. And one of the questions we ask when we hire for a job is, do you know the difference between criminology and criminalistics? And if they don't, we don't hire them. He was hired before I started working here. But anyway, as many of you know, I've been in law enforcement for 36 years. And in law enforcement, I really enjoy it because one of the things about coming to work, as soon as you walk in there, you know all the dirt that's going on in the city. You really do. You know what's happening, where, and who's doing what to who, and why they're doing it, and all that other stuff. And one of the things that came to my attention a couple of months ago involved President Hinckley. And I got to relay this to you because I don't know how many of you are aware of this. But as you probably know, the general authorities in the church, many of them don't drive to their assignments on Sunday. They have a chauffeur or a driver that will drive them to their assignments. And it was a few months ago that President Hinckley was going to speak in a state conference down in Provo. His driver appeared that Sunday morning to pick him up, and as he walked out, President Hinckley came out and he noticed here's a brand new Lincoln. And he was impressed. It only had 43 miles on it. And everything was power, and it's just beautiful. And he kind of sheepishly asked the driver, he says, "Do you mind if I drive down there? I've always wanted to drive something like this." The driver said, "Sure." I mean, who's going to say no to the president of the church, you know? He said, "Sure, go ahead." But he says, "Can I ask you one thing? Do you mind if I sit in the back? Because I've never been driven before. I'm so used to driving." So he said, "Sure, that's fine." So they got in the car, and President Hinckley started driving, and he got on I-15 and started heading south. And I don't know, I've never been in a new Lincoln before, but I understand they're smooth and so forth and quiet. And as he was driving, he looked in his rearview mirror, and here's a highway patrol trooper. He looked down at his speedometer, and he saw he was doing 90 miles an hour. So he pulled over to the side, and the trooper came up. He looked in the car. He saw who was there. His face got a little red. He said, "You stay here. I'll be back in a minute." And he went back and got on the radio, asked for his sergeant. He says, "Sergeant, I've got a problem." He says, "What's that?" He says, "I've just pulled over a very important person for speeding." He says, "So who is it? Like, is it the mayor?" He said, "Oh, no, more important than that." "Is it the governor?" "Oh, much more important than the governor." "Is it the president of the United States?" He says, "No, more important than him." And he came back and says, "Who in the world could it be?" And the trooper says, "Quite frankly, I don't really know, but I can tell you that President Hinckley is his chauffeur." Anyway, now comes the challenge, because I'm going to start walking. You want to follow me around?
Yep, I have to.
Stay there. I'm going to do my best to stay. Can you see this in the back?
No. I can't see it in the front here.
That's bad.
Can you lift it up a little bit?
That's why I wanted to stand over here, at least, to get out of your way.
Yeah, that's much better. Put a book there.
How's that? We're going to try this and see what happens. Probably you'll be the ones that can't see the pictures now, right? See me. So I'm going to walk a little bit so you can see. Anyway, February 26th, 2002, Deseret News. National Park Service officials are investigating a discovery that, if authentic, could implicate Brigham Young in the Mountain Meadow Massacre. But several aspects of the discovery indicate it may be a hoax. On January 22nd, a National Park Service volunteer was cleaning an area of Lee's Ferry Fort in Glen Canyon National Recreation Area, Arizona. And discovered a lead sheet with writing on it. The Park Service volunteer uncovered a lead sheet beneath several inches of rat droppings near the fort's fireplace. Letters were scratched on the lead sheet, which was rolled up. Now that was the Deseret News. I want to read the Tribune's coverage of the same incident. That way you'll know I'm not biased or prejudiced. In what may be a hoax or a historic puzzle piece, The National Park Service is attempting to authenticate a lead scroll allegedly inscribed by John D. Lee that claims LDS church leader Brigham Young ordered the Mountain Meadow Massacre. The lead scroll was buried under several inches of accumulated rat feces near the fireplace inside Lee's fort on the Colorado River southeast of Kanab. A Park Service volunteer was removing the droppings to prepare for stabilization project on the structure, which has been closed for several years. If the scroll is legitimate, it's profoundly significant, said journalist Sally Denton of Santa Fe, New Mexico, who viewed the object while doing research for her forthcoming book, American Massacre. Whenever I hear about a new document or some new historical find, I have to admit that I'm a little bit suspicious. And when there's such a controversial item that's found, it seems like immediately people take different sides. Some will automatically jump and say, oh, that's genuine. Others will say, there's no way that's genuine. And they seek this to confirm their preconceived ideas. I have a little thing in my desk at work, and it says statistics are used to substantiate preconceived ideas. This is very similar to that. They found the scroll. It says Brigham Young's involved. A group of people say, yep, that's true. A group of people say, no, that's not. And then there's a group that says, gee, we don't know, or do we care sometimes? But anyway, that's what happened here. And whenever I see something that's new, I guess I'm a bit cynical because of my past experience. I do know there's such a thing as forgery. Several years ago, in fact, it was almost 20 years ago, I was talking to a well-known historian, and he was also an authenticator, if I can use that term. And we were talking about ways that you can authenticate historical documents. I actually called him because I was curious. In my professional organizations, they wanted me to find out, how do you authenticate a document that's 100 years old or more? Because the work that we do in today's professions are bad checks or phony contracts or forged wills, things similar to this. And so I called him to find out what techniques they may use on historical documents that we didn't use today. And I was surprised when the answer came back and he said, why would anybody want to forge a historical document? It was about a year later that Mark Hoffman actually answered that question. But since that conversation, I've been heavily involved in looking at things other than what most document examiners look at. There was a long period of research that went into discovering how documents can be artificially aged and forged and things similar to that. But before a document can be before a document can be examined and authenticated, there's a whole series of tests that have to be done. It's not just one, or it's not just two. If I were to come up and give you a $100 bill and say, is this genuine? And you looked at it and saw that it was red ink, you wouldn't have to examine the paper or look under a microscope to see what type of printing was used. You could tell immediately that this was not a genuine bill. So sometimes it's easy to eliminate things. It's much easier to eliminate them than it is to actually authenticate and say this is a genuine document. Over the past 20-some years, I've worked on some very interesting cases. We mentioned the Hoffman documents, which I worked on. But also, there was an incident that took place in Texas called the Alamo several years ago. And the University of Texas in Austin had boxes of documents that tended to change history. And they were discovered in an old abandoned house or something. I don't know how many of you remember this. This was about 15 years ago. Well, they sent me four of those documents to look at, and after examination, I said all four of them are forged because the printing wasn't even available at the time that this document was dated. They subsequently went back and found an entire section in the university had been forged over a period of about 15 years. Also, several years ago, I got a baseball jersey, which I was so impressed with. It belonged to Babe Ruth. For those of you that don't know Babe Ruth, he was the king of SWAT, a baseball player. And he died in 1948. This jersey that he had actually autographed right up in this portion with his name, and there was a letter of authentication that came with it explaining why he did it, because he donated it for a charity, which is neat. They were selling that jersey for $750,000 in San Francisco. There was one problem when I conducted the examination. Remember, he died in 1948, but the pen used to sign the name wasn't manufactured till 1976. So either he was miraculously resurrected long enough to sign his name, or it was forged. Just last summer, I was called on a Declaration of Independence that had been found in the floorboard of a car in northern Idaho. That would have been worth about $6 to $7 million. It wasn't. And finally, I want to mention this one. For those of you that remember or heard of Amelia Earhart, she was flying, I think it was during World War II, sometime during that era. Thank you. I didn't know that. All I knew was long before I was born. And she crashed. That wasn't bad. But she crashed someplace and they don't know. Miraculously, there was a bottle that washed up on the shores of Washington. And as they opened that bottle, there was a note there from her pilot, who was Fred Noonan. And it was saying, "We have crashed, Amelia's dead, I'm dying, and I wanted somebody to know." And they just found that bottle washed up. Now, it was the same type of wine that Fred Noonan was known to drink. And one of the universities had already authenticated it as being a genuine document. But it was quite a crude forgery of his handwriting. It was thrown out. So I guess I cite those things just to tell you maybe I'm a little cynical when these things come up. And quite frankly, it's extremely rare that I ever see a genuine document. Most of the time they're forged. And I think that's too bad. This is going to be kind of difficult because of the lighting and so forth. This is the lead scroll that was found in Lee's Ferry. When it was first found, it was submitted to Bill Flynn, who runs the Affiliated Forensic Laboratory in Phoenix, Arizona. There is a dimmer? Oh, let's see what happens. Timer. Nope. Sorry about that. See if they work. Maybe you can dim it a bit. Don't do it so I can't see this, though. Dim the front ones. There you go. Good. Okay. Can you see that better now? Hopefully. Anyway, that is the scroll, and then there's a measuring device around it, a ruler, so you can see how big it was. That was submitted to Bill Flynn in Phoenix, Arizona. And after it was through, they submitted it to me for confirmation or verification. I didn't know what he said. We actually did the examinations totally independent. And afterwards, we spoke to Christine Gertz of the Parks Department. She was the archaeologist at the time. And Bill and I were both in agreement that this was forged. But because of the controversial nature, we thought maybe we should go a little further than the examinations we initially done. There was a meeting that was to be held in San Diego within the next month. It was a meeting of the Southwestern Association of Forensic Document Examiners. There was about 70 to 75 document examiners from around the country that were there. And Bill and myself put on a two-hour presentation showing the slides and other things that we took, pictures of the scroll, telling them about our techniques and getting input from them to see if we had forgotten anything and if our evaluations were correct. Afterwards, it was interesting because everybody agreed with our findings. It was unanimous that it was a forged document. However, in spite of that and in spite of the reports that we have, there's now been three books?
One book and
two articles or something that maintain that this is genuine, totally disregarding the examination that was done. What I want to do is discuss what is a document, first of all. Since I'm a document examiner, it would be good to know what is a document. And a document can be anything. It can be a handwritten paper. It can be the spray painting on a wall that you sometimes see.
Yeah, it's even been an apple and a radish at one time over the years. These have actually been documents that I've examined. But to do a forensic examination, we try and do at least one of three different things. We try and determine the origin of the document. We try and determine the authorship or who wrote it, if possible. And then also we try and look at it to see if it's authentic. So there's three different types of things that we need to answer before we can write our report. The lead lease scroll, if I can call it that, was different than most documents, yet we used exactly the same techniques. Although it wasn't on paper, it was on lead, and that was, so we examined it the same way we would. First of all, you look at the circumstances of its finding or the provenance. We look at the handwriting comparison, since there was handwriting on this. We look at the words used. It's called syntax. We look at how the words are used and various other things associated with the writing itself. We look at the materials, not only what was it written on, but what was used to write on it. And then we look at the consistency of all the other findings. No, we don't look at the content. Most of the documents I examine, I never even read what they say because they don't mean anything to me. That's left up for the investigators or the historians in this case to determine if the writing is historically accurate or if the dates are right. We don't worry or concern ourselves about that. Let me tell you about the provenance, which is the first thing that we look at. The newspapers gave an account of the discovery of the National Parks Department, and they issued their findings. But as most articles are, they're not accurate, not completely accurate, or they leave out certain things that's going to be important. As a result of some of the things lacking in the press releases, Steve Mayfield and myself decided we were going to travel down there and actually do a complete forensic examination on the fort itself to find out what it was really like, and then we can begin our examination from there. I might just mention, I don't know how many of you know Steve, but I'm very impressed with him over the years. I call him my multidisciplinary, quintessential, ultra-expedarian. And if any of you know what that is, that's good, because that's Steve. In other words, he's quite an observer. And one day this last, a couple of months ago, we went up to the Uintas and we went camping together. We hiked in about 2 miles, I mean. We had a dinner over the campfire, and we was going to bed. About 3 o'clock in the morning, I woke up, and I turned to Steve, and I said, "Steve, wake up." He woke up. He says, "What do you want?" I says, "Look up. What do you see?" He says, "I see the stars." I says, "And what does that mean?" And then Steve, typically going through all of this stuff, he says, and I got to read it because I can't remember this. He says, "Astronomically, it tells me there are millions of galaxies and probably billions of planets. Astrologically, I observe that Gemini is in Leo. Horologically, I deduce the time is approximately a few minutes past 3 a.m. Theologically, I can see that God is all-powerful and that we are small and insignificant. Meteorologically, I suspect that we will have a beautiful day tomorrow." Then he said, "Why? What does that tell you, George? What do you see?" I said, "Steve, it tells me that some jerk just stole our tent." But he is very observant. This is a picture of Alan Malmquist, who is the, as the newspaper article said, the volunteer employee. Alan has been down there for over 30 years working full-time as the park ranger, and the reason he was a volunteer is because at his present position, he can only work 8 months a year, approximately 115 hours a month. But because he's so dedicated, he works more than that. But as soon as he runs out of hours, he's a volunteer. And so that's why they call him a volunteer. He's probably, in our opinion, the best expert there is on that whole area down there. He literally wrote the book that's used by the Parks Department about all of Lee's Ferry and all of the surrounding areas down there. We spent an entire day with him, and it was just quite an experience I won't soon forget, I can tell you that. But anyway, he's holding the lead scroll, as you can see. He took us out to the fort. This is Lee's Ferry. Or at Lee's Ferry, this is the fort. It's different than I envisioned it. But anyway, that's the fort where the scroll was found. And he showed us the exact location where it was found.
Was he the person who found it?
Yes.
He found it, yes. And that's why it was fortunate, because we didn't have to worry about all the other stories. We got it strictly and directly from him. Steve and I began to take the measurements and draw diagrams and take photographs inside, outside, everything that could be significant. Now, you got to remember that the information contained in the scroll indicated that John Lee, on January 11, 1872, wrote on this scroll. It was 130 years later that it was found by Alan Malmquist. In fact, January 22, 2002, real close. It was found in this fort, which was boarded up, barred up, and closed to the public. But it would be a natural place to find something since this fort was built there by John Lee. But let me tell you the history of the fort, since we're looking at the provenance of this document. The fort was actually built in 1874. Remember, the document was signed 1872. But the fort was built 1874. It was occupied until sometime between 1932 and 1942. There were people in it all the time. So it just wasn't laying around all the time. The Department of the Interior received ownership of the fort in 1966, and then it was unoccupied about 1976 when they went in and they actually dismantled the roof, the walls. They treated it, they reinstalled it, they stabilized the walls so they wouldn't fall down. But the new roof they put in fell down in 1985, so it was closed down again. In 1996, they put a new roof in there, brand new roof. Some of the people have maintained that maybe the scroll fell out of the roof. But anyway, it was closed to all visitors. In July of 1999, Robert Graham, who was a historical architect with the Archaeological Institute of America, was preparing to do a structure do a report for Congress. He entered the old fort and he took pictures of the interior. Now, although it's not really obvious, can you show him where it is, Steve? Although it's not really obvious, there is the scroll. It's partially covered up by dirt, but it's also sticking out a little bit. He never thought a thing about it because there were old tin cans in there and so forth. He took a picture. It was covered with so much mouse and rat droppings, he got out of there as quick as he could. But we know it was there when he took that picture.
Was that the first time somebody went in?
That's correct.
They've been in and out of this thing for years, but after they closed up, in preparation of cleaning up the fort.
Got it.
This is all dirt and crap in there, but yeah. Alan Malmquist later on said, that's it right there.
What's the year?
July of 1999. Steve will give you the exact date. He's got it.
Can you orient us? I can't tell what I'm looking at.
This is a fireplace right here.
This is
a fireplace that goes up. This is the ceiling that goes across. This is the floor, and right there is the scroll partially covered and partially uncovered. Again, it looked like a tin can, as you'll see later. Now, in 2002, which was 3 years later, was when Alan Malmquist went back there. This time it was his job to go in, clean it out, and prepare it so it could be restored. When he went in there, he walked in and he saw it, and he thought at first it was a rolled up piece of leather, and there were three or four other soft drink cans laying around in there. But because of hantavirus, if you know what that is, they went back and he wore his suit and he sprayed it down with a Clorox type solution to kill the virus and so forth. And then when he picked it up, he knew what it was. I mean, this is his job. He's been doing it for 35 years. He knew immediately what it was. And so he took it into his possession and took it back to the office so they could do the examination. So how about the provenance of this particular document? Does it have a good provenance? Nope. All we know is that sometime between 1996 and 1999, somebody threw it in. In fact, as we did our examination, it was thrown in through this window.
No.
Yes, that one. That's the window.
On the north window.
That is the north window.
No, that's the east window.
Sorry. No, it was thrown in through that. We're going to argue about it, but remember, I'm his boss and I'll win out. It was thrown in through that window because you had to reach in and throw it around. The other one was barred out.
No, east slot. North.
There was no other way that scroll could have been there other than being thrown in. It couldn't have been thrown in through that window. There was another window on the other side which was totally boarded up and so forth. And even if we disagree, it was either through that window or there was another one right next to it. They were gun windows. They were about this tall and about this wide. And they were that thick. So somebody had to reach their arm in and throw it to get it in that particular location. It couldn't have come from any other place. Yes?
Could you explain again why it couldn't have fallen from the roof?
Because the roof had been replaced twice since it was abandoned. Totally taken apart, and all that was left is a big beam, which you can see that beam there. That beam is this big around. Everything else was taken off, removed, refurbished with new stuff, and put on there again and sealed twice in the previous 20 years. This one is 1999. That was after it was restored, the roof. That's why it couldn't have been there, because the roof had been replaced twice in recent years, and we don't know how many times it may have been done before that.
It couldn't have been there when people lived there.
No, because that's right in the middle of, watch your foot, that's right in the middle of the floor. People with that room is about this big. What was it, 15 feet or something like that?
People have been living there for years and using it. It was the Spencer Company used it as a mess hall. More than just John Lee Dealey and his people were not living there. A lot of people have been in there. Over the years, there's been a lot of scavenger hunters and things looking for stuff.
And realize it's a cement floor. Except they didn't even know it because there was so much dirt on it. But it's a cement floor, and it was swept clean, and it was used, and it was a mess hall, and all. They're not going to let it build up all the dirt and rat droppings. This is what happened in the previous, about 15 years after it was originally shut down. But it had to have been thrown in because of this is when it first appeared, and we know when the roof was replaced. It had to be in that 3-year period. So the provenance on that is, it's unknown. We don't know where it came from. But it certainly hadn't been there for 130 years. It just couldn't have been. Next, this is a signature that's on the scroll of J.D. Lee. You can see part of it. I wanted you to see that. Because the next phase of the examination will be to do a signature or a handwriting examination. This is something that I typically would make up when I testify in court and try and present something to a jury to show you that handwriting was or was not done by the same person. This top signature is the signature that was on the scroll. When I was doing the handwriting examination, I found John D. Lee's writing for a 32-year period. I had over 126 different documents from the LDS Church, the Huntington Library, and even a stone wall where he inscribed his name down at Lee's Ferry, for those of you that are aware of that. This is from a document in 1876, which was done just about, you may know better than I, but about a year before he was executed. This was one done in 1844, which was significantly before the date. And this is the one that's actually, it's a picture of the writing that's done on the stone wall down outside of Page, Arizona, about 40 miles out of there. He was traveling through there once and he scratched his name on the wall. Christmas. And then later on, yeah, it was on Christmas
Day.
And then later on he mentioned in his journal that he did it. And they went back and they found it. It's called Signature Rock now. There's a whole lot of other signatures there too. But the thing that I noticed was the consistency in all his writing. And I want to just mention a couple of things because some people have said, gee, that's his handwriting. It looks the same. Pictorially, there's some similarities, but when you look at it, there's none whatsoever. And the interesting thing, he wrote the same way in 1844 as he did in 1876. He wrote the same way when he wrote on paper or when he wrote on stone walls. His handwriting is the same. so it wasn't really affected by his ability to write on the scroll itself. But if you'll notice, there's a double line that goes down on the J on all of these, but there's only a single line that goes across. But on the scroll, there's a double line that goes across horizontally. Now, if somebody's writing on a scroll, why would they do additional strokes? If anything, you'd think it would be more difficult, so they would do fewer strokes. But the opposite is actually true. Some people have even said he was sick at this period of time, which from his journals we know he was sick. If he was sick, that means he would probably want to write less instead of writing more. But in each of these lines, he actually adds an additional line that's not necessary. And as you go through each one of them, again, we got a double line going vertical on the D's, but we've only got a single line that curves around on the scroll. The E's, well, the L and the E, if you'll notice, there's something called a serif. And that means when you cross horizontally, it then comes up. Can you see how that does that on the L? But on his, it doesn't. It just goes straight across and it stops. And this is just his writing on his signature. There's writing throughout all of the scroll, and all of it is the same. There's just absolutely no correlation between his regular writing in that 32-year period and the writing that was found on the scroll. And if you can see that, this is the actual writing that's on that rock we told you about. Somebody has taken some chalk to put in there to make it look a little more visible. Unfortunately, they did. But anyway, the handprinting on the scroll is just different from the handprinting that we have of John D. Lee. The next thing we have is something called syntax. This is a way of determining the author by the way they write. Everybody has a certain writing style. And it's a very complicated thing, and there's very few that I'm aware of, professional people that do that. In fact, I'm only aware of two that do it professionally. One's in Connecticut and one's in California. Dr. Jerry McMinimum is a professor of linguistics at California State University in Fresno, and he is one of the two that has been recognized throughout the country as offering court testimony relating to syntax analysis, and he's published a couple of books on it also. He was in San Diego when we made our presentation on the scroll to the meeting that I talked about a few minutes ago, and I asked him about it. I says, could you do a syntax analysis on this? And he says, in order to really be certain, you need a whole lot more words than he was able to work with. But he did offer some suggestions on what he observed while he was looking at that and what I could do to follow up. And these are some of the things he told me to look for. He said, one, notice that the scroll is all in capital letters. There's no small letters in the scroll whatsoever. This is unusual because Lee wrote only the first word of each line, or the first letter of each line was a capital. All the other were small letters. He never wrote in capital letters to speak with. Also on the scroll, they use dashes instead of periods. Whenever a sentence ends, they put a dash. We could find no instances where Lee ever used a dash. He always used a period. The scroll was hand printed, and we found out that Lee used to hand print, but in fact, it was page 60 of his diary in 1846, I think it was, he turned over to cursive. And he never wrote in hand printing the rest of his life, except for a very few limited things, like when he was addressing an envelope or maybe writing a poem or something like that. Spelling errors that we found. The spelling errors on the scroll, we found, as we averaged them all out, was 15.5% of the time he made an error in the spelling. But on his regular writing, he only made an error 4.4% of the time. That's four times more spelling errors than he would normally write. Another simple word such as have, H-A-V, is how he spelled it on the scroll 2 out of 3 times. And yet all of the other writing was H-A-V-E. Why would he misspell it? I don't know. He also, on the scroll, he used the present tense when he was writing, but in his regular writing, he always used the past tense. Instead of saying, I have this, he says, I have this. And that was different tenses that was used. And finally, the average sentence length on the scroll was 9.25 words per sentence, where his normal sentence rate was 19.7 words per sentence, significantly more. So as you look at the syntax that would have been done on that, there's just really no way that was his syntax either, or the way he normally writes. Next, we started looking at the writing material itself. This is a picture of the lead itself, the lead plate. The analysis was done by Thomas Brunty from Arizona State University, because I'm not a metallurgist, I don't do that. They did that. And they made an interesting determination, and his job, by the way, he's a graduate student at the university dealing in religious artifacts. Notice how pliable that is. See how it bends? And did you notice also how brown it is? The brownness was what we tried to look at, and when they examined the scroll, they found that it actually came from a mine in southern Missouri. In researching that further, the mine closed in 1865. But it's not unusual to find lead from that mine, because that was the major producer of lead for the entire United States. Ironically, it opened again in 1950. So the report, although they said the likelihood is that it was produced before 1865, there's a possibility it could have been produced after 1950. They don't know. I checked up at the University of Utah and talked to Dr. Sizamarmam Guruswamy, and then I also talked to Dr. Michael Free. Both of those are metallurgists up at the university, and I asked them about this brown appearance. And they both said, in fact, Dr. Free was interviewed by the news media a year ago. They don't know what that brown is, because that shouldn't be on lead. It's not corrosion, it's not rust. They said lead actually turns gray when it starts to show signs of corrosiveness. And this is brown. They were unable to actually process it because nobody asked him. But he said it was highly suspicious and they don't know why. I asked them, could that be somebody's attempt to perhaps try and artificially age it or make it look older? That's possible. There's a lot of ways they can do it, but it's certainly not natural. And so that's as far as we got on that. After that, you can see how pliable it is, and it really surprised me how easy it is to write on. We actually got a piece of lead, a lead sheet, and I did some experiments on that. I got a stick pen, and was able to write on it. I could write in cursive, I could write in printing. I got a screwdriver, I took a paper clip and unfolded it. You can write on this. It was quite surprising how easy it was to do. But as we looked at it closely under the microscope, we noticed there were certain consistencies in the impressions. And as we looked at that, we found something real interesting. The writing on that was done with a four-sided nail, a wire nail. Well, I don't know what that means to you. It didn't mean anything to me. So we had to go back and start doing a new area of research, was the history of nails. I didn't know there was history of nails, but do you know there's entire organizations out there? More than 400 people in one of the organizations. I was fortunate enough to get a hold of a Dr. Jeff Oakes, who's an associate professor of mathematics at the University of Indianapolis, and he just happened to finish writing a book recently on nails. He referred me to two other professors at the Louisiana State University. '77, which was 5 years after this was done, supposedly. So the nail wasn't even available at that time, let alone out in the middle of the desert. So again, the lead, maybe. However, the nail, no way. It just wasn't used. So in summarizing this, and this is all the country down there, it's beautiful country. We look at the provenance of this lead sheet, no. It had nothing to do with Lee. Handwriting? No, it wasn't his. Syntax? No, it wasn't his. Materials used? Possibly the lead sheet could have been, you know, from a wagon train on the Mountain Meadow Massacre. But the nail wasn't around then. Consistency? No way. If you want to have a score, the final score is genuine, possibly one, forged, five. So the score is 5-1, if you will. There is absolutely no scientific evidence that would indicate this was a genuine scroll written by John Lee and left at that particular period of time. Who did it? Well, we don't really know who did it. Steve's going to get up and talk about that. I don't know if you recognize this guy. he's somebody that used to be famous. His name was Mark Hoffman. And Steve's going to talk about him. But anyway, if there's any questions, we'll do it afterwards because of our time restraints. But I thank you very much for the opportunity to be here.
I hope you all took good notes on this because afterwards there'll be a test. And in the forensic field, you have to get 100% on anything or you don't get certified. That's why I don't look at fingerprints. That's why I don't look at documents. I just take the photos. Okay, yeah, go ahead, Melvin.
Do you know when the cement floor was put in? Was that by John B.B.?
No, that was 1902. Probably one of the various occupants there. I want to make one point perfectly clear, and I want to repeat this three times so everybody gets it. This is not a criminal investigation. Can you hear me? Oh, hey, that would help. This is not a criminal investigation. Again, this is not a criminal investigation. Just because we work at the crime lab, this has nothing to do with anybody we suspect. There is no police going on. This was a private, independent thing that George and I did, and it got me away from my house for a few days and got him away from the work, and we got some free sandwiches at Subway because of it. Anyway, long story. One of the things that we've learned, especially in Mormon history, especially in Utah, when it comes to documents, is the legacy of Mark Hoffman. And I'm amazed at when this scroll was found, how quick people were to make judgments. If we've learned anything, is to be, we need to be very cautious, not to jump either way, and allow testing and proper analyzation of these things to come forth. As George has said a number of times to me, and I've stolen it, if it's hard to believe it's true, it probably isn't. Did I say that right? If it's too, yes. And, or his other famous line, if you're going to buy a document, make us the cheapest one, because it's probably forgery anyway. And this does not just deal with Mormon stuff. There are people out, there are a lot of things out there. We have this rock box they found over in Jerusalem that had James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus, that's being questioned. And yet you can see the same thing in that, where people are joining either side. You know, yes, it's real, great, you know, proof that Jesus was what he claimed to be, and other people saying, well, let's look at it. Because it was acquired from an antiques person, those professional organizations that deal with antiquities like that said, we're not even going to think about it twice, because we don't trust these antique dealers when they come up with stuff like this. It's kind of like the last Indiana Jones movie, if you remember, where his father hits him overhead with the vase and laments the fact that it was a Chinese vase and hit him, and then he kind of started laughing like, you know, oh, look, it's a fake, you know. These things are out there, always have been. Mark Hoffman did not invent forgery, but he learned from other people's mistakes. Let's make one point perfectly clear. He is not the greatest forger of all time or the greatest forger of the last century. He's the greatest forger of the last century that ever got caught. There are other people out there, probably the day after he went to the prison, probably today, maybe 10 years down the road, that will learn from his mistakes. And all I can say for people like George and myself, that's job security. Part of the complex issue with this investigation, or that we did on it, is the hurriedness that came from the Park Service. You need to give the scientists, the experts, time to look at it, but because of the pressure from the media, they hurried on that. So these other tests that we've been talking about, they really didn't ask. However, when we contacted them this past year and said, we'll come down on our own dime, they were more than pleased to have us help. Also, this Thomas Brunty was talking about, that was on his dime as well. You think that people in the government want to spend money, but if you volunteer to do it for them free, they will give you every opportunity. That's what happened. That's why Alan was there to help us. His official title, by the way, for those who are taking notes, Alan Malmquist is the Lees Ferry Interpreter. That's his title. Kind of a unique title. Instead of historian, he's the interpreter. And he's very sensitive. Let's consider Mark Hoffman. I can give you the $100 answer to that question or the 10-cent answer. The $100 answer is, I had to write it down because George told me to, I do not have enough evidence to say with a certainty that Mark Hoffman made the scroll, but can't exclude the possibility with what is known. That's a $100 answer. 10-cent answer, I don't know. Okay. I've done some little background checking. Let's take some of the similar possibilities that Mark may have had something to do with this. First of all, yes, it's LDS related. It is controversial. Historians have said that if this were real, this would actually be something in his handwriting implicating Brigham Young. It would also add on fuel to his confessions that have been questioned because this was his confessions were edited by his attorney, Bishop, and they have doubted whether that was really Lee's words or Bishop's. 1989, Mark was in prison at the Point of the Mountain, and he attempted suicide. When they removed him to the hospital to check him out, they did what they call a shakedown of his cell. That's where they searched for contraband. Under his mattress, they found a one-page sheet of paper. On one side was listed famous Mormon or Mormon-related documents I have forged, and on the other side was Americana people, famous Americans, Paul Revere, George Washington, so forth. Among those listed, and I think there was over 60 Mormon-related names he had listed, was one John D. Lee. Well, we all kind of look at each other, and those, and George here looked at all the Hoffman stuff, and other people said, we have no idea what he's talking about with a John D. Lee. Well, that was forgotten by a lot of people until, again, last year when this document comes up, then people start remembering. Could this be what he's talking about? The Deseret News and KSL TV made a request of Jack Ford, the PR man for the state prison system, to ask Mark if he had anything to do with it. Jack Ford informs me that about three or four times a month he gets requests from the news media to go down and see if Mark will do interviews. He takes a walk down to the prison. Mark, will you talk to him? No, I won't. He comes back and says, sorry, he doesn't want to talk to you. However, he did go down there and ask Mark, and this is an exact quote. Mark said, I have nothing to say about it at this time. It's a simple yes or no question, Mark, yes or no. But Mark, being the manipulator he is, was just going to sit back and see what would happen. I've written to Mark a few weeks ago asking about it. The prison sent it back to me with a note on it. They didn't deliver it, saying we need to have his full booking number and his full booking name. My first thought is, he's the most famous person you have in the prison and you can't find him? I felt like writing, saying it back on the envelope, saying, just ask Dan Lafferty, he knows where he is. But I resent that letter. But one of the myths that we have about the Mark Hoffman case, and it's the fact that Mark won't talk to anybody or write or correspond. This is not true. There have been some people who have corresponded and he has written back to them, particularly a Dr. Marks in Boston who had purchased a Daniel Boone forgery, and Mark was willing to tell him all about it. There's a book dealer by the name of Jennifer Larson who has corresponded with him. Mark also has one of his daughters he communicates with. But I think he picks and chooses who he wants to talk to. Last September there was a Hoffman Forgery Symposium in Salt Lake with Ken Sanders Books, and the word we got back with all the publicity that Mark was not happy with this symposium and that the rumor going around was that his attorney, Ronnie Engage, did not want him to talk to anybody. So we'll see if he answers letters or not. This document, Mark did deal with metals. He did make metal coins. He made plates for the Oath of the Freeman. Also, one of the distinctive natures of Mark's forgeries was the fact that there was always a flaw, always an error, always a problem. They were never perfect documents. On this scroll, you will see that there were three holes punched in the corners, not four, but three. The idea maybe these were used to put on the side of the walls or on the roofs of homes or so forth, but that's missing. It's a little flaw, and Mark did this all the time. Mark believed that you won't find any document that's perfect. When he manufactured his documents, He sometimes would artificially age them or put rips or tears in them. George and I had the opportunity here earlier this year to go down to the archives at Brigham Young University, and they showed us some of the original handwriting revelations used for the Doctrine and Covenants. And except for the browning of the paper, they are almost perfect. The handwriting, no errors, no scratches, no tears, nothing. They are perfect because the family that had these preserved them. So it kind of beats off the fact that it's possible to have a perfect document and have it preserved. But Mark thought differently, and this one would definitely qualify. Now as to the possibility that Mark had nothing to do with it, I've talked to both Ken Farnsworth, an investigator on the case, who said that during the Mark Hoffman case, they did a background check to see where Mark had been, where he'd gone, where he'd traveled. He says, we have no information of ever having gone down to southern Utah or Page in particular. They did find, when they searched his home following the homicides, some copper plates that were smaller than an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. Those three, but they were copper, not lead. Mark was not one to just leave a document. Mark always had to be the one to find it, to take some credit for it, and it was just not his nature to just kind of leave something to chance. Again, we know that in 99 it was there and it wasn't found 2 years later. Not typical of a Mark Hoffman activity. Plus the fact that, let's forget that one, let's see. Now, when you come to the question of the fact that if this scroll is authentic, or the material, so the lead plate itself, remember that Mark himself would go up to the universities and rip off end pages out of these old books for his papers, that if any testing was done on that paper, it would come back positive. A lot of end pages out of these old books are missing because there's nice little slices where Mark would go up and do that. So, let me repeat one more time. This is not a criminal investigation. I'm sure someone's going to say, well, they went down there, must be checking it out. There's not a criminal investigation. It's not a crime to write somebody else's name. I could write a piece of paper, write Babe Ruth on it, and throw it on the ground. If you want to believe that's his handwriting, that's your problem. Okay? Now, if I pick it up and I gave it to you and I said, this is Babe Ruth's signature, but I wrote it, will you give me $5 for it? And he said, sure. No crime. You knew what it was. But if I pick it up and say, this is an authentic Babe Ruth, I know it is, will you give me $5,000 for it or whatever? And you say, sure, I have now defrauded. Nobody's been defrauded all this other than what we want to believe. Now, what are the possibilities if it's not Mark Hoffman? Well, this is what's fun, just kind of thinking what could be, what couldn't be. There's a possibility that indeed Mark Hoffman might have produced it, but sold it to somebody else, maybe in 1985, and quickly they discover that, whoops, I've got a Hoffman. This person has held on to it and decided, what can I do with it? So they take it down there and toss it in to kind of antagonize the whole thing. There are people out in the world that have Hoffman forgeries that have not come forward with them. A few years back, George received about, 7 documents from one collector and said, can you tell me these are Hoffman's or not? Well, Mark, he eliminated 3 of them right off, says, yes, I know these are Hoffman's because I've looked at these before. And he had little marks that he leaves on them. The other 4, he discovered were Hoffman's, but we had no record of them ever being there before. They are out there still, because Mark really never confessed to everything. So it's possible that somebody might have had it from Mark and decided to just eliminate it, although it would have been better just to come forward and say, hey, I've got a Hoffman forgery. Might not get all your money back, but you might get something for it, because some people are paying for these forgeries. Then the question is, maybe there's another person who has forged it. If not Mark Hoffman, that tells us that there's probably somebody out there doing it. Now, why would they do it? Obviously, abandoning it in the fort means they're not interested in the money, which indicates you may just have simple cases of somebody out there wanting to play a little hoax, a little joke on us, toss it in the fort, have it be found, and watch the rest of us chase our tails, which, except for a nice trip to Page, maybe that's what we were doing. But the main thing is that if it's not Mark Hoffman and it's a forgery, there is somebody else out there. And again, there's somebody that I can guarantee from my profession that there's somebody out there who's read all the books, tried to find all the scientific facts, and will probably try to make a better mousetrap. so to be. George hasn't mentioned this, I hope you excuse me for revealing some of your secrets, but he will go to his grave with some of the information about how they deciphered forgeries. They will not reveal the whole thing, because once you reveal everything you know, there will be a crook out there who will learn from it. So even the scientists, especially in law enforcement, we don't necessarily tell everything. And anyway, let's, if we can learn, my last point before we close here, since we only have a few more minutes, the legacy of Mark Hoffman tells us that we need to be very cautious when things are found. We need to be very careful. Not the fact that some document might be real, but we can't just jump on and go through the media and get all excited and have TV crews down there and the media and radio interviews and all this stuff. And because someone says, I think it's real, it should be real, I want it to be real, we need to be patient with it. So, anybody have a quick question? Yes.
All I know is what they told me back there.
Could these have been nails that were used later?
They said the four-sided drawn nails weren't even patented until 1876, I think it was, and they were first done over in France, and they weren't distributed until 1880. And again, if there are, there's always exceptions to the rule, but even if that's true, it still doesn't change it. I've got to change one thing, though. I got to apologize to Steve because he was right where that was thrown in. I checked my notes. It was the window that wasn't shown.
On the north side. I put my arm in and I tossed something in and it just, there were the windows on the west, on the east side, on the north, there were the gun holes. The door was secured, but the Alan Malmquist said it had been kicked a number of times, and on the west side there was an open door but it had bars on it, and I kind of tossed something in as a kind of a test, and that most test kind of looked like it was most likely from the north side gun hole. Yes, you have a question.
I was wondering if you were able to find fingerprints on that.
Don't even try. Number one, fingerprints are from the moisture left by the person's hands or palms. It's been sitting in there for a number of years, so they probably disintegrated, unless they were able to be burned into the thing itself, and plus the fact that Alan cleaned it off. So he would have, if there were, he would have cleaned it off. It's very hard after a period of time to preserve fingerprints. Yes?
What is the difference between criminology and criminalistics?
Criminology is the study of the criminal mind. Criminalistics is how do they do it. We deal with physical evidence, not the brain. Okay.
Ron?
I have a question on control and syntax, analyzing syntax. You mentioned the statistics. When you have a very short document, how do you relate that to a larger writing?
Say that was one of the reasons why it could not be done with the degree of scientific certainty. What they do, though, is you find there were 74 words in that one. You go through the journal and you find comparable entries of approximately 70 to 80 words, and then you do the analysis from there. So you're not comparing big, long things to little, tiny things. You're trying to do it as close as possible. And again, that's not my profession. All I did is what he told me to do, but it's not for certain.
Is there a major difference when you do
the
extensive text?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, but we're out of time. If you have some more questions, come up. We also have some pictures that were taken out before it, and thank you for coming.
Steve, that was really enjoyable.
Oh, thank you.
You did a great job.
Oh, a little nervous, but I think I survived.
Oh, you did a fantastic job.
What do you want?
Good stuff, Steve.
Thank you.
That picture of Mark, boy, he looks different now.
Yeah, he's a lot different. That's an older one, too.
Well, I have a salamander. But other than that,
I'm glad he conceded your point about the window. I was going to come to your defense. Last year, after NHA in Tucson, I drove back up through there and met Alan Malmquist, and he took us over to the building and opened it and showed us the picture was more obscure if you hadn't been there, but I've been there, so I saw the fireplace, and he pointed right to, in fact I have a picture,
that's what I have over here too,
of Alan standing there pointing to right
where it is, yeah,
where it was, and he showed us which window, and I know it was the north, that northern component.
Well, see, that's why, yeah, my testing was to go down there and, you know, you could sit at that far west wall for the large facility, but you could probably it'd take a lot. You could, if they somebody kicked the door in, it cost them possible, but it just the way it landed and the way it looked,
yeah,
it just,
and that's what he said.
You know, my arms would reach in, toss it. It just seemed more easy that way. And those were not secured like areas were. So yeah, it just he kept insisting, and I would argue with him. So.
But yeah, you were definitely right.
I didn't know that's what you did.
The Browns.
Very good.
I'm a criminologist, or a.
I'm curious.